I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome back to Countercurrents Radio. This is our third weekly show. Today, what we're going to do is discuss some recent events connected with the alt-right, white nationalism, and identitarianism. But before that, I would like to thank some of our donors. We've had a really good week, so bear with me. I'm just going to go through this very quickly. I'm going to say the first names of people, unless it's such an obvious first name that, you know, people could almost infer who it is. Otherwise, if it's a very common first name, it's not like it's going to break anybody's OPSEC. So first, thanks to Bjorn for $100. We received $300 from David, $150 from S, $5 from O, $100 from Dominic, $10 from JD, $10 from S, $10 from Richard, $10 from Matthew, $100 from William, $14.88 from Andrew, $5 from Michael, $20 from M, $10 from another M, $50 from Sarah, $10 from Vlad, $10 from F, $20 from Paul, $5 from Colin, $150 from Steve, $50 from Jean, $20 from Andrew, $10 from Edward, $20 from Alex, $30 from Steve, $10 from Glenn, $10 from another William, $100 from Edward, $10 from another William, $25 from Matt, $10 from Peter, $5 from Casey, $10 from yet another Matt, $100 from Steve, $100 from T, $15 from James, and $10 from John. I didn't even have time to add that up, but it's really quite substantial. Thank you so much, guys. I'm going to be running an update for the first little more than a month of our summer fundraiser very soon, probably this coming Monday. And we're humming along quite well towards our goals, so thank you very much.
Yeah, so we all thank you.
Big increase from last week, so that's always nice to hear.
Yeah, it's a big increase in numbers, in something of an increase in an amount, too, because we did get a $1,000 donation in one fell swoop last week. So that's very substantial, but support at all levels is really important. And again, thank you so much. So what I'd like to talk about is a number of recent books are coming out or have come out on the alternative right, white nationalism, identitarianism, and things like that. And there's a new book out that is number one at Amazon. Correct me if I'm wrong, John. It's called The Devil's Bargain or Devil's Bargain by somebody named Green on right. Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. That's number one, and I understand that Milo's book, Dangerous, is number two. So a lot of people are reading about people like Bannon, people like Milo, alt-right, alt-light ideas, the new nationalism, what have you. And there's been a teaser from the Bannon book published, I believe, at Vanity Fair about Bannon's interest in traditionalism. So, John, you're going to be reviewing that book for Countercurrents. So do you have some thoughts about it, preliminary thoughts?
Yeah, I'm hoping there's a lot more information on this in the book itself when I get it. But, well, of course, earlier this year, there was an article in the New York Times which highlighted the fact that Bannon had given an address to the Vatican 3 years ago where he mentioned Avila just in passing. And at the time, on Facebook and then later in an article that I it was the talk I gave to the New York Forum. I cautioned people against reading too much into that because it really was just a passing reference, and it didn't seem to me that it really meant anything all that significant. But then this Vanity Fair article came out, and apparently this author has, Joshua Green, has been in contact with Bannon for a number of years and spent many hours interviewing him. And he says that it came out during his interviews that Bannon told him that back in the 1970s, when he was serving as an officer in the U.S. Navy, he was very interested in René Guénon and actually said that, you know, Guénon was somebody who had inspired him, you know, down the path that he's taken politically. And also apparently he spent a period at that time as a Zen Buddhist, although he apparently before long he came back to Catholicism. But that was extremely interesting, I thought. I mean, I still, like I said, I hope there's more about this in the book, and it's impossible to derive just from this article exactly what Guénon, you know, really means to Bannon. I mean, maybe he just, I mean, he read him 40 years ago. Maybe he just sees it as something that was interesting at the time, but he's moved on from that, or, you know, maybe on some level he still thinks of himself as a traditionalist. I mean, it's hard to say just from the article, but it's just interesting the fact that he would actually go out of his way to mention Guénon as an influence, which I think indicates, you know, that on some level there is a very deep similarity between Bannon's worldview and ours. I certainly wouldn't try to say that this is going to have some sort of impact on the Trump administration, and that, you know, that the Trump administration is a traditionalist regime or anything like that. But still, I mean, it's probably the first time that an American politician at the national level has even, you know, heard of Guénon, let alone been influenced by him. So it's something very interesting. And I certainly, when I write the review, I'll mention whatever I can learn about this in the book.
The very fact that he mentioned Evola at all is interesting enough. For most people, writers like Evola and Guénon are simply not on the radar, and especially people involved in Republican politics, even edgy Republican politics like Bannon, it's just unheard of. And so I found that really very interesting. I think Bannon is a much deeper character than most other people on the right today. Certainly probably the guy who has the deepest thoughts who's circulating around the White House. I don't imagine that he's handing a copy of The Crisis of the Modern World to President Trump and saying, you really need to read this. It'll help formulate your foreign policy or something like that. But it's still quite fascinating. Yeah, there's a huge question as to how these ideas might actually influence concrete political strategy and policy. I mean, that's a huge question mark. But simply the fact that there is somebody in the administration who doubts that progress happens is a big change, right? Who doubts, probably doubts the idea of a specific religious advantage to, say, Christianity. You know, I mean, there are all kinds of premises.
Well, it did say in the article, though, that Bannon mentioned that he tried to mix Guénon with Catholic social thought.
Mm-hmm.
Which apparently he's also very interested in. So I don't know. Maybe he does still see Christianity as, you know, being the religion of the West. But the article was unclear on that point.
Yeah. But Catholic social teachings are objectively pretty outside the mainstream of the United States as well. It goes towards really right-wing critiques of capitalism. And there are certainly signs of those sorts of ideas circulating around. For instance, with simply the idea that we need to have regulation on trade and things like that to preserve the American middle class. That is pretty revolutionary. That's an older kind of right, not the classical liberal stuff that passes for the right in the United States. And of course, that was very commonplace for a long time in the United States. Really, it only became, you know, free market thought only became a dogma after the Second World War on the right. But that's generations ago for most people. And for a lot of people, the very idea that there were right-wing critiques of capitalism is seems completely bizarre. It seems like a contradiction in terms. So for somebody like Bannon, who again has a great deal of political influence, it's questioned how much exactly, but I think he does have a great deal of political influence. is aware of this older tradition on the right is itself really, really interesting.
I think a French friend of mine actually forwarded me an article that I hadn't known about after I posted something about the Vanity Fair piece, in which apparently Bannon was in France earlier this year and addressed, I can't remember what it was, but it was a right-wing gathering. And apparently he favorably cited Charles Marat as well as Jean Raspail. So
again, yeah.
It's clear that he has a great deal of familiarity with the continental rightist tradition, which should be very heartening to people like us. And I've been trying to, there's been a number of articles about Bannon's reading. Journalists seem to be really interested in this. And he's also, apparently people claim he's really fascinated with the Bhagavad Gita, that he's fond of quoting that. And there's also these two American writers who he's fascinated with, Ho, and I can't remember the other's name, but they have postulated this idea that American history proceeds in these 70-year cycles, which is also, you know, kind of Spenglerian or traditionalist-esque in a way. So, yeah, there's clearly a lot going on intellectually for this guy. So it's definitely something that's a positive for us, I would say. I mean, like you said, we don't know exactly how this is going to manifest itself, but just the fact that he's there is heartening.
It's not your boomer parents' conservatism, basically,
no.
Is what we're talking about here. Yeah, it's very exciting, no matter where he ultimately comes down on a lot of political policy questions. Just the fact that his mind is so Catholic in the small sense, so wide-ranging, has such intellectual curiosity and has such a breadth of a broad sense of political options, a much broader sense of political options than anybody in the mainstream conservative world, I think is exciting. And I think that's probably why he saw so much potential in Trump, because Trump is really outside those narrow boxes of post-war American conservatism as well.
Yes. Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, I suspect Trump kind of stumbled into these ideas, but I think Bannon even gave an interview to Vanity Fair last summer where he said something like, well, Trump will be our blunt instrument, you know, sort of referring to, well, you know, at the time he was still with Breitbart. So I guess, you know, he meant the alt-right essentially. You know, he'll be our blunt instrument to sort of get these ideas into Washington.
Yeah, it's sort of like my metaphor of the icebreaker, the ice-breaking ship, you know, crashing through the crust of political convention and opening up some options. And Trump really is that. I mean, he is an unstoppable force just as a human being. He's he's so high energy. he hardly ever sleeps, apparently. You know, he sleeps like 3 hours a day. He's just always on the go. Little things like that. Napoleon slept very little, apparently. And it just gave him a systematic advantage because while his enemies were asleep, he was awake plotting. And, you know, other things being equal, the guy who, you know, puts in more hours of work a day is going to have an advantage. So, I mean, Trump has all kinds of personality traits that give him systematic advantages over anybody in the political sphere. And I think having Bannon on his side is definitely an advantage as well. So let's put a bookmark in this then and wait until you have read the book and have a review in the making. Then we can return to this. I just received an advanced copy of another book that is coming out this fall from Columbia University Press. It's by a political scientist named George Hawley, and it's called Making Sense of the Alt-Right. And George Hawley has written three other books. He's amazingly productive. I've only read one of them. It was called Right-Wing Critics of American Conservatism. That came out.
Excellent book.
An excellent book. It came out from University of Kansas Press, I believe, a couple years ago. And I was very impressed because the guy is a very solid researcher. He's traversed vast areas of literature that I have read in my own intellectual development, from people like the agrarians and the paleocons and the libertarians and so forth, as well as the conservative revolution, the European New Right, and things like that. And so he was, in a way, the perfect guy to write a book about the alt-right when it became a big issue last year. And he has come out with this book. It's a shortish book. I read it in a day. And I was very, very impressed. Basically, what Hawley is he's an honest academic, a very rare bird indeed. It is not written in a tendentious, axe-grinding Gawker or HuffPo style. It is written in a very restrained, lucid, objective way. He sifts through and analyzes the data. He identifies the hysteria of the left about the alt-right, the sort of paranoid ideation that they engage in very effectively, which I think is almost a brave thing to do. it's like trying to be the adult in the room while these people on the left sort of have a nervous breakdown. But he said that the fact that Donald Trump had the support of people on the far right did not, of course, justify them in saying that he had a far-right administration any more than the fact that if Bernie Sanders had become president with the influence of, say, the 7.5 Maoists in the United States, that Bernie Sanders was a Maoist and it was about to enact the Great Leap Forward again. So it's a really good analogy. So he tries to calm down these hysterics and give an objective appraisal of what the alt-right really is, how much influence it has, and what its future is. And in terms of his analysis of what we're all about, it's very, very accurate. I didn't have anything to quarrel with. In terms of his analysis of its influence, I think he's, again, very sober. The alt-right doesn't have that much influence, right? Its primary influence is scaring people on the left into thinking that it's a far bigger thing than it is. And that is a kind of influence, I suppose. But it doesn't really shape political agendas very much. And in terms of his analysis of the future, I think he's basically correct. He seems to believe that the brand is essentially dead. Hailgate killed it for the most part. I would agree with that. I think the alt-right as a brand is putrefying now. And it died last November, and it's getting rotten now. And the direction of the broader alternative right, the rejection of mainstream conservatism and flirting with white identity politics, that kind of stuff, or civic nationalism, is probably going to develop down other channels under other brands than the alternative right. So I think he's very sound on all these things. I was really very pleased, somewhat flattered, actually. He interviewed me for the book, and a lot of my interview is quoted in there in extenso.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and also he quotes a number of my articles, and so I felt good about this. Richard Spencer is quoted extensively, but of course he is the guy who coined the term alt-right and has been the most visible person connected with it, especially since last November. And also Lawrence Murray is extensively quoted in it, which made me feel good because he's a friend of mine and he has said a lot of really good stuff. It comes off really quite well. Gregory Hood gets mentioned in it and quoted once. And a large number of other people that I know, the Right Stuff guys, are mentioned. It's a very carefully researched, thoroughly documented, judiciously researched thing. He knows how to pick the right people to quote and the ones who are just trolling. You know, he has a sense of who's being in earnest and who's trolling and so forth. So it'll be out, I think, in September from Columbia University Press. I will actually write out a proper review of it when it appears. But just as a preliminary impression, this is going to be a really good book. It's going to be a good book for us in the sense that it accurately assesses certain ideas that we stand for or sympathize with. And I think it'll be good for political discourse because it's going to filter out a lot of paranoid ideation and hysteria and bring a kind of calm and rational assessment of this. His tone is very neutral, but he uses these sort of loathsome liberal euphemisms like undocumented immigrants and African Americans and all that kind of stuff to identify.
Oh, he has to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that that's where he is. You know, I don't know where he is politically, but he seems like a moderate. Well, put it this way. He seems like a sane person. So given the dearth of sane leftists anymore, I'd say that he's got to be some kind of political moderate. You know, I don't think he can be a left-wing radical and have written this book. Probably, you know, a sort of a center-left academic is basically the bead that I have on him. But anyway, like I said in my review of Right-Wing Critics of American Conservatism, he's not one of us, but he's something far more useful. He is a fair-minded and honest observer and critic. And we need fair-minded and honest observers and critics. We need that feedback loop so we can take stock of where we are and maybe do better. So all told, I think it's a very positive development.
I'll just mention, because you were talking about Richard, that, you know, he was, Bannon talked about him in that Vanity Fair article. I found it kind of amusing that apparently Bannon referred to him as a goober.
Yeah, I don't get that. I mean, Richard, you could use a lot of terms to describe Richard, but goober doesn't seem to fit. Never in a million years would I call him a goober. He called him like, what, a self-promoting freak or something?
Those were the two quotes, although, well, I guess he just wants to put some distance between himself and the Richard Spencer brand of the alt-right.
Yeah, I
can't blame the administration for wanting to do that.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, Trump is disavowed, and so, of course, he's got to do it, too. Yeah, I thought that was interesting, though. So let's mention a couple more things, and we'll wrap up. One is, you've been cited, your article on identitarianism, I'm told, was cited in a Hungarian Jewish publication. So what's the story there, and do we have to be worried, John?
Well, I wasn't involved in this, but Mike and I are in contact with the Hungarian branch of Generation Identity. I think they've been around for a couple of years, but they're making a more concerted effort to do more these days. Mm-hmm. And a couple of weeks ago, I guess a few weeks ago now, they asked me to write up sort of an introduction to identitarianism that they could translate into Hungarian and put up on their site. So I did that. And coincidentally, at this time, they were asked for an interview by this publication. Mike, what's the name of it? I remember you told me earlier.
Hetek.
Hetek, yes.
Yeah.
I had never heard of it, but what they told me is that it's sort of like a right-wing Jewish publication. They do actually have that in Hungary. And my Hungarian is not nearly good enough to be able to read the article, but one of my Hungarian friends read it and kind of summarized it for me today. And apparently the interview is just them going over the basics of identitarianism and talking about how it's a break with the old right. And they want to get beyond, you know, chauvinistic nationalism, especially within Europe, and, you know, that they're not racists and, you know, stuff that we would all, you know, take for granted, but that it was probably news to the kinds of people who are reading this magazine. And they referred to me, I think, as an American researcher, I was told in the article, and they quote my article extensively. I I don't know exactly what parts, but there's a lot of passages from it in there. So I'm glad that I could be useful in some ways for the Hungarian cause, the identitarian cause. But yeah, it's my understanding. Well, we're going to talk about this later, but you know, that there is actually a connection between at least some of the more moderate forms of Hungarian nationalism and the Jewish right and the Israeli right. There actually was a guy, a Hungarian Orthodox Jew I met here. He's not part of Hungarian Generation Identity. He's part of some other group here. I don't even know if it still exists, but I was talking to him once that, well, how can you be an Orthodox Jew and be part of a Hungarian identitarian group? And the way he justified it was he said, well, you know, multiculturalism and globalism, those are also going to destroy traditional Jews as well, not just the Hungarians. So he said, I don't see any conflict in being an identitarian in that sense. He said, you know, that the struggle is, you know, of all the identities against globalization. So yeah, if that's the approach that they take, I'm all in favor of that.
There seems to be a big divergence between the Jews who remained in Eastern Europe and are still here today and the American Jewish population who really have put themselves on the far left of the political spectrum and to the point where there's a big divergence between them and Israeli Jews and them and continental European Jews, which I think is interesting because the only conservative magazines that you ever found in America were neoconservative magazines in the Jewish community. So,
right. That's sort of the Jewish right in the U.S.
Yeah.
So I understand that Netanyahu is actually in Budapest right now and was meeting with the leaders of the V4. What's up there?
Well, I've talked to some Hungarians about this and I've read a few articles. This has not been explicitly given as the reason for the meeting, but everyone thinks that it has to do with the fact that for the past several months, the Hungarian government has been having this very open and public conflict with George Soros and his various NGOs. He has a number in Hungary. Probably the biggest manifestation of that recently has been the conflict over Central European University, which I actually wrote an article for Countercurrents about a couple of months ago. But basically, CU is an American university in Budapest that George Soros founded and funds and sort of still shepherds. And it's widely seen here as a vector for American-style liberalism into Hungary. I mean, I've gone to a few events there since I've lived here, and many of the instructors are Americans, American Jews, professors. They're always integrally involved in any kind of protest against the government that happens here. You always see you taking the forefront in any kind of anti-government activity. And also, you know, most of their, well, I'm not sure if it's most, but certainly many of their students are not even Hungarians. I've talked to Hungarians about this and they said, yeah, the average Hungarian couldn't afford to go there. And most of them wouldn't even care to because they have to pay to go to CU as a foreign university and under the Hungarian government auspices, they can attend any Hungarian university for free. You know, it's covered by taxes in Hungary. So it's mostly foreign students who go there. So it's a real vector of the whole Soros agenda of globalization in Hungary. And shortly after Trump was elected, the Hungarian government announced that they were going to go after all of Soros' NGOs in Hungary. Because, you know, they didn't really believe the Trump administration would back him up on that. I guess it remains to be seen if that was overly optimistic or not. But in any event, this CU thing is part of that, and it's still ongoing. They passed a law that basically required any foreign university in Hungary to also be operating a campus in its country of origin, and CU only exists in Budapest. So they don't have any campus in the U.S. And they passed this law, which everyone widely interpreted to be directed mainly at CU. And there were all these protests here in Hungary that, you know, mostly Budapest's liberal community and foreign students at the university were attending. But, you know, they were actually quite sizable, in some of them in tens of thousands of people. So it created a stir, and the government has now agreed to allow them to operate for one more year while they figured this out. So nobody knows if it's actually going to be shut down or if they're going to work out some sort of a compromise. But that's been the biggest element of this whole conflict. And just in the last few weeks, the government has put up billboards and posters all over Budapest, and I hear other parts of the country as well, with a picture of George Soros on them. And it says in Hungarian, Soros, we will not let you have the last laugh. And, you know, they're quite literally plastered everywhere in public spaces across the country. So this conflict is very real and palpable in Hungary right now. So ironically, Fidesz, which is Viktor Orban, the Hungarian prime minister, his party apparently has a relationship with the Likud, which is Netanyahu's party, and that's the right-wing party of Israel. And originally, the Israeli government was taking the view that, well, you know, this stuff is all anti-Semitic. When you attack George Soros, you know, that's just a surrogate for Jews worldwide. And all of a sudden, in the last couple of weeks, they've kind of backtracked on that. And I think it was actually Netanyahu himself who came out and actually criticized George Soros for what he was doing and claiming that, you know, the policies that he favors in terms of migration and so forth in Europe are not beneficial to anybody and to security in Europe. So that took a lot of people by surprise that Israel didn't stand by Soros, since, you know, it's always been assumed that they were working together. I've read in some articles that, you know, we should still take this with a grain of salt, because it's also been shown that the Israeli government works with Soros's institutions regularly. So it might be that this is just all for show. But nevertheless, they did make this statement against Soros. So it's seen that Netanyahu coming now is sort of like him taking a stand alongside Orban against this. And I think Orban and Fidesz probably see this as a wild card, you know, that they can play against Soros to kind of show that, oh, look, you know, the EU and Soros, they call us racists and anti-Semitic, but look, even Netanyahu is coming and endorsing us. So I think that's what's going on. I mean, the ostensible reasons are they're talking about cultural and trade initiatives between Israel and Hungary. Like, apparently Israel wants to have some cultural initiatives here, and Hungary wants to start buying Israeli natural gas. So those are the ostensible political reasons for why this is going on. But it's really all revolving around this whole Soros conflict.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Any politicians, I'm always suspicious of their motives, and I think it really always boils down to just practicality, not idealism.
Fidesz is not an ideological party. I think I should make that clear to the listeners. I mean, they're very much a populist party. And Orban will go, you know, wherever he thinks, well, both his own interests and perhaps secondly the interests of the Hungarian people lie. So, yeah, it's not, we shouldn't think of them as some kind of an ideological rightist party, because they're really not. And that's why, you know, to them, I mean, Hungarians, as I know from many experiences, tend to be very, very suspicious of Jews. But, you know, Orban's not going to let his prejudices get in the way of a political opportunity like this.
No, I understand that. And I think that ideology and practicality rarely work in harmony with one another and can be quite disastrous when you try to force an ideology through. And I think the Hungarians of all people are very well versed in that, having lived through communism and totalitarianism in the past. So
why don't we segue into the shop talk segment, unless there's more to say on this.
Well, Netanyahu was caught on a hot mic in a meeting with the V4 heads of state, And he was actually captured saying that Israel is on the side of Europe in halting the migrant crisis, which I thought was remarkable, because a lot of the reason we're in the situation we are now is because America got involved in wars on Israel's behalf in the Middle East.
Yeah, I'd like to see some action on that as opposed to a few soothing words. It's interesting that he even feels the need to placate us with lies, though. I mean, that in itself is kind of interesting.
Well, for a while now, Israel's been cultivating ties with right-wing parties all over Europe. I mean, it's almost a requirement if you're a right-wing party in Western Europe that you have friendly relations with Israel. You know, like the Front National and UKIP and every party I can think of in Western Europe. That's almost like a litmus test that they have to have good relations with Israel and the Jewish community. So I guess Netanyahu sees an opportunity there.
Right. As I was saying before, it really comes back to an alignment of mutual interests, you know, immediate necessity and economics. So,
well, I think the reason why you see more right-wing Jews now, like in France especially, you know, there's like Finkelkraut and other French right-wing intellectuals who are actually writing against mass immigration. And I think it's just because, you know, when mass immigration started in Europe, and also the sort of ideals of 1968, it was to their advantage because they thought that they could alter Europe. And of course, also the same thing was going on in the U.S., but they thought they could alter Europe in such a way as to make Europe safer for them and more in tune with their interests. But I think some Jews have woken up to the fact that if Europe becomes the new caliphate in 20 or 30 years or whatever, it's not going to be advantage of Jews. So I don't think we can talk about Jews in terms of one camp. I mean, there's obviously several, and, you know, even they have their own internal disagreements.
Yes, yes. I think that they're becoming even greater, as I mentioned before, between the liberal American Jews for the most part and the Jews living on the European homeland who actually have to deal with the direct consequences of Arabs coming into into the European nations.
Yes.
And of course, Netanyahu benefits from that because he is all about solving the demographic threat in Israel. And he hopes that more European Jews will immigrate and come home to Israel. That's one of his stated aims. So,
well, that's actually an interesting point, because that's another thing, is that if you listen to what Jews are saying about Europe, I mean, it's, you know, like anti-Semitism is practically at Third Reich levels now, and you know, every synagogue has to be an armed camp, or, you know, everyone will be massacred. That's probably why they're stoking that in a way, because they want Jews in Europe to get frightened and want to come to Israel, I assume.
Well, and mass Muslim immigration also helps stoke that and force more Jews to Israel. So honestly, Netanyahu's agenda for Israel is probably forwarded by the migrant crisis rather than retarded by it. So let's segue to our Shop Talk segment. This has all been very, very interesting. I appreciate you guys pointing out some of this stuff about, well, what's going on in Hungary right now, especially with Soros and Netanyahu and Fidesz, Orban. We've got a bunch of stuff happening for Countercurrents, so I just want to run through that for our listeners and give you a heads up. So first thing is speaking events, public events. I am going to be at the American Renaissance Conference. I'm going to have a table there. That is the last weekend of this month, so basically the weekend after this coming weekend. And please look me up. I'll be hanging out with my entourage, basically, and selling books, signing books, and so forth. And if you are a fan, a reader, an author, whatever, and you want to meet, please look me up. Second thing is this. Ever since 2010, we've had a Francis Parker Yaki Memorial Dinner in the summer in San Francisco, because 2010 was the 50th anniversary of his death in the San Francisco jail. And We have tried to do that around the date of his death, which is the 16th of June, but that's not always possible. So we have our 8th Francis Parker Yockey Memorial Dinner scheduled in San Francisco for August the 5th. I wish I could be there. I can't make it, but there should be lively conversation from a lot of Bay Area and Northern California nationalists. And if you would like an invitation, it's a private invitation-only event. If you'd like an invitation, please email me at editor@counter-currents.com. Also in August, the Northwest Forum is meeting in the Pacific Northwest, August 26th, Saturday, August 26th, and the headline speaker at that event is Jared Taylor. I will also be speaking. There will be a third speaker as well. If you want to hear Jared Taylor speaking about basically his experience as a white advocate for 25 years now, his ethos that's kept him going for that long and so forth, what made him do something, please get in touch. He's also going to be signing copies of his latest book, If We Do Nothing. And again, that is August 26th, Saturday, August 26th, in the Pacific Northwest. So contact me if you want to get an invitation to that. Again, it's a private invitation-only event. Contact me at editor@counter-currents.com. And finally, in September, there is going to be another Francis Parker Yockey event because September 18th is his 100th birthday. And I'm going to be giving a talk and a slide presentation with a lot of previously unseen photographs of Francis Parker Yockey. And I'll also talk a bit about the state of the art in Yockey research, upcoming volumes that are coming out. There's a definitive biography that Kerry Bolton has written of Yockey. And on September 18th, we're also going to have the release date of The World in Flames, which is a collection edited by Kerry Bolton of all of Yockey's surviving shorter writings and correspondence. We wish there were more that has survived, and maybe there'll be subsequent editions as more things come to light. We can only hope. But this will be the definitive collection of all of his shorter works. The other works out there, of course, being Imperium and The Enemy of Europe. But everything besides Imperium and The Enemy of Europe is going to be in that volume. Also, Charles Kraft is doing a Francis Parker Yockey memorial plate and inaugurating a new series called Thought Criminals. So that should be really interesting. And then I guess we can talk a bit about books. We're having two books come out this month. We've just announced them at Countercurrents. One is Fenech Soler's novel, Rising, and the other is a third collection from Countercurrents of Jonathan Bowden's speeches called Extremists, Studies in Metapolitics.
So, which I just finished proofreading today.
Yes, I'm really excited about that. So we're going to bundle that off to the printers, and the release date will be actually the weekend of Amren. So next month, in August, we have four books that I am scheduling for release. The first is You Asked For It, which is the first collection of my interviews, Selected Interviews Volume 1. I'm very ambitious. I expect I'm going to be doing lots of interviews into the future, and I've already done enough interviews for three volumes. So that interviews collection will be the first. It's basically a complete speech from my point of view, where I talk about all the issues that I talk about in my books and other fora, and I figured that since interviews are one accessible medium that a lot of people like, why not just get interview volumes out there? And hell, if there can be interview volumes with somebody like Foucault, why not the Greg Johnson interviews? So I'm inaugurating a new series. Also, Kerry Bolton's book, More Artists of the Right, will be out in August. And a long-awaited volume by Anthony Ludovici, Confessions of an Anti-Feminist, which was supposed to be published posthumously shortly after his death. And it's taken decades, but it is finally out, coming out. So Ludovici's autobiography, Confessions of an Anti-Feminist, there'll be more about that. And we're going to do pre-orders for a special edition, special limited edition. And finally, long-awaited, is North American New Right, Volume 2. which I think is going to be the last volume of that series. But it's going to be a gorgeous collection, beautiful to look at, great content, and it's about time. And then we've got a few other things coming up for maybe September, certainly in September. One is Chris Pankhurst's collection called Numinous Machines, which is going to have beautiful cover art by Charles Kraft. A volume we mentioned last week as well, the Countercurrents Interviews Volume 1 that Mike Polignano and I have edited. We are bringing out a new novel by Tito Perdue, his most recent novel. It's called Sinashura. It's a romance novel, a novel of supernal love, as he puts it. And then a collection of short stories by J.A. Nichol called Venus and Her Thugs, which we talked a bit about last time. So there's a lot coming out from Countercurrents. In year 7, we managed to put out 4 whole books. In August of year 8, we're going to be putting out 4 whole books, and we're going to keep going pretty much at that rate until the end of the year, because now that we've got John working full-time and Mike working full-time, there's a huge logjam of production that is being broken, and we're going to see quite a lot of new material.
Yeah, there's a lot of exciting stuff on the way. I've seen the list stuff we've got, and we're of course always looking for new things as well.
Oh yeah,
I think people are going to be happy with the sort of stuff we're going to be offering.
I agree. So, guys, are there any last minute thoughts before we wrap up? Anything you want to add?
Nothing comes to mind.
Well, great. Well, I think this has been a really good conversation, and we will be back in a week's time with more of Countercurrents Radio.
Bye-bye.
See you later.